Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, we visit with Dr. Jonathan Larson, extension entomologist with the University of Kentucky. And as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, everybody's laughing. Vicky's over here. Are you having equipment malfunctions?
Well, I just thought I'd move that right after you started recording.
When it had set perfectly fine for two other episodes.
I know. Yeah. I changed my seat.
Her face was the best. Okay. Her face was what was...
I was not looking at her face. I just, out of my peripheral vision, I saw equipment being moved.
And I was trying to be extremely quiet, and my face was going to help me do that. The face I was making was helping me be quiet, I think.
You know, when Indiana Jones is trying to switch the thing off the pedestal, that was kind of what she looked like.
That's what it was. Okay. Yeah, that was that's a good analogy. Yeah. That was good.
Sorry, the listeners couldn't see that.
Yeah, which I had a picture.
Glad we did not adopt that YouTube channel.
Yeah.
We might all be getting a little weary. It's later in the afternoon. We've recorded a few shows back-to-back to cover us for the next few weeks. We're actually recording this a week to the day before Christmas, before our break starts. But this show will actually be airing the second Monday in January. Okay. So we hope for everybody that's listening to this that you had a happy new year, a safe New Year's Eve, and a Merry Christmas all together. And all those resolutions are behind you now. You've done forfeited those. You're ready to move on with the rest of your year.
They lasted all of a week.
Maybe.
That's right. So I got a guest with us today, Dr. Jonathan Larson. Good afternoon, sir.
Howdy, howdy. How's it going?
Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Talk a little bit, and you're officially a retread now. You've been on the show with us before. Glad to have you back. But talk a little bit, for anybody who might not have heard you before, a little bit about how you got involved in extension, where you come from, and how you got to the University of Kentucky.
Happy to do so. So I got into extension young. I was a 4-H'er back in Indiana, where I'm from. And I was always doing sheep, and I did cattle a couple times. And once we were doing those kinds of things, my dad had a rule that you had to have an indoor project. And one year I picked entomology, just kind of out of the clear blue sky. And I won my county fair. I was the only entrant, so it's not impressive. And I got to go to the state fair. And if you go to the state fair in entomology in Indiana, you get to go to a day in the department at Purdue University. And I went there, and I was like, oh, my gosh, this is so weird and wild. I think I want to do this for a career. And I found out you could talk to people about bugs, and I kind of haven't stopped ever since then.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
That is pretty cool. Neat story of a day at Purdue. I kind of like that idea. Well, maybe somebody will adopt that at some other university for state fair winners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, the good thing about Indiana, they are bought into the 4-H thing. Anytime you go up there, look at their county fair facilities. I mean, and I'm sure it's with the other projects as well. So, I mean, kudos to them for doing such a fantastic job with that.
You know, we're all three located in Western Kentucky, but I think about the facility at Evansville David's talking about. It is a really nice place. When you look at some of the facilities that they have around the state, they do think a lot, and they put a lot of investment into their 4-H programs.
That is very true, and that's a pretty cool story of how you get into your career, because we all have our ag story, but I've not heard one like that. So
that is true.
That's good. Yeah. Interesting. So you got led from Indiana eventually to Nebraska.
That's true, yeah. I went to Purdue for my undergrad. I did my doctorate degree here at UK, and then I spent 5 years out in the hinterlands of Nebraska as an extension agent in Omaha, Nebraska.
Really?
Yep. Yeah,
I did not know that.
I didn't either. We are learning a lot today.
I didn't know that.
I remembered you were an agent in Nebraska, so you worked in Omaha, actually.
I worked in Omaha, so that's where about a third of the population of the state of Nebraska lives. I was technically an urban entomology extension agent. I was one of two in the state, and we got to talk about bed bugs and roaches and termites a lot. But when I was there, they were experiencing the first emerald ash borer invasion. They were getting invaded by Japanese beetles. Some people there had never seen it before. So that was an eye-opener for somebody from Indiana/Kentucky, since we've been dealing with that for like 100 years over here. Right. It was a lot of fun being an agent, but I was really happy to get the opportunity to come back to Kentucky and be a specialist here on campus.
Did you ever eat at the California Taco?
No, I haven't.
There's a place in Omaha, and I took a bunch. We had a judging contest out there, livestock judging, at the I think it's Exarban. Exarban is out there, and so I love the Food Channel and all that stuff, and so I Googled to see what Guy Fieri had eaten out there, you know, Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. Well, there's this little place called California Taco. I said, man, I'm going to take these kids there.
So
we load up a van load of kids and take down there. And so we pull up into the parking spot, and right in front of us, the cops have got some guy slapped up on the trunk and cuffing him. And they go, do you really think we need to be here? I said, it'll be fine. Let's go.
It's all good.
I said, I've drove 8 hours. I'm going in there to eat. I don't care what y'all are.
The problem is leaving.
Yeah, that's right.
It's in hand.
But I didn't know if you'd ever eaten there. Omaha, Nebraska story. Yeah.
No, everybody out there, they want to take you to a steakhouse. That's usually the Omaha.
Oh,
Omaha
true. Yeah.
It's really good. The tacos are really good.
I'm going to have to try it when I go back and visit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I've got a few places I can ask you about Nebraska as well, but we'll do that off the air.
There you go.
No, enjoying Nebraska a lot. Had a chance, like a lot of people, on Interstate 80, traveling back and forth through the state. But I've got some friends in the west central kindly part of the state, and enjoy going out there quite a bit.
The wide open parts.
That's right. Yeah. Nebraska gets good, in my opinion, once you get past Grand Island.
Okay. Yeah.
Once you get there, you know, start heading west, it levels out and turns into some pretty good farm country there for a long time.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, but I did not know that you were a county agent. I did not know that.
No, but
learn something every day.
I know, exactly. I didn't know that either, and so that gives you an idea, or that's why you always, when anytime I've called you about something, you kind of give an answer like an agent, or you know, or in your explanation of how to talk to this person, it's like you're an agent, and now I know why, because you were an agent.
I knew he was different. I knew he was different. I didn't know why, but now I know.
Yeah,
he can identify.
Yeah,
with the problems that we have.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. When you've lived that life, you know exactly how it is.
Yes.
I knew it.
That county agent life.
I
can see it on a T-shirt now. Hashtag that county agent life.
And getting the insect calls as an agent sometimes is very interesting.
Well, yeah, because what are your backgrounds in? What are your degrees in, the three of you?
Animal science.
Agronomy.
Yeah.
Ag business.
So not a lot of bugs in any of
those. No.
Yeah, so I sympathize. When you get all those calls, somebody says, oh, you know, I found this black speck on my wall. It's got more than two legs. Like, what is it? It's just, it's not something that you necessarily were prepared to have to deal with.
Yes, well, and I think it bugs in general make people uncomfortable. And so the folks that are calling in, or that come into the office, they want an answer right now, and I don't blame them, but you know, I think people just get a little bit nervous.
I think Vicki's right. You know, typically bugs have a negative connotation, and when most folks do come into an extension office, it's a problem. Those of you who can't see my air quotes, but, you know, when they have a bug, it's a problem, because they only think of bugs being a negative. We've got a lot of beneficial bugs out there well. Yep. Some of them are showing up in folks' houses right now, all across the landscape. So.
Yeah. But, the multicolored Asian lady beetle you're referring to?
Exactly.
Yes. I mean, it is really good when it's outdoors. They eat, an individual lady beetle will eat about 5,000 aphids over the course of its life. That insect in particular does help with soybean aphid when we have problematic years with it. But then in the fall, they see your house and they think it's this deluxe heated cliff, and they want to move in, and they're going to take advantage of your attic, your soffit, all those different spots, and use it to keep away from the cold.
Best one I heard was a news announcer on a local news station here not long ago, just past couple of weeks actually, and he had a picture of a lady Asian beetle. And he said, you know, but these are not ladybugs like everybody thinks of. He said, these are lady Asian beetles. He said, not the good kind. And I thought, they really need to know what they're talking about.
Yeah, actually, I hear that a lot, or I see that a lot, like on social media. I like to troll around and see what people are saying about different bugs. Yeah. And with that one, there's one image in particular that shows up really frequently, and it's a picture of inside of a dog's mouth. And there's
I've seen that.
A multicolored Asian lady beetle stuck on the roof of the mouth of this dog. And they say, oh, they're not, they're fake ladybugs. They want to get in your dog's mouth and they bite and then they will drink blood from the, I mean, there's all these like wild things.
Have you not seen that, David?
No, I have not seen that.
Yeah. And there's just so much about it that it's hard to pick up. Like, they do bite if you pick them up, they will nip at you. They are from Asia, but they are real lady beetles. I mean, they're just not a native one. They taste bad. Usually dogs try to spit them out after they get them in their mouth. But you have a ridged mouth. You could get something stuck up in there. And the ladybug's going to try and hunker down. So, I mean, there's a lot of misinformation about them out there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the real ladybug part always throws me for a loop. Yeah. They're in Coccinellidae. That's the family name. They're the ladybugs. That's who they
well,
are.
Well, I think when people think of a ladybug, they think of a red ladybug with black dots.
Yep. And these ones, they can have lots of dots. They can have no dots. They're kind of more of an orangey, kind of yellowy color typically. But the multicolored stands for the fact they can be bright orange, dark red, but they always have an M on their thorax, which stands for multicolored Asian lady beetle. So it's very helpful.
And if you can see that.
It's pretty prominent. If you look at a picture of them, you'll see it there, on, like right on the top of the head. It looks like a big block M.
There you go.
You're going to be looking the next time you see one.
Probably not.
You have to get his glasses on so we can see it.
Squish first, ask questions later kind of guy. Yeah.
That's profiling. We're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to identify.
I always like the picture I get from about 10 or 15 feet away, you know, and they go, what kind of bug is this? I have no idea.
Or after it's
I
been
I probably don't have any idea
on.
Either. Yeah, or if it's been squished already, you know. What kind of bug is this?
You know, David, you say that, and I always interject this, but we think of something when we're doing a show about some other show we should do sometime in the future. We really should consider doing a show sometime on just how to submit samples to your extension office, whether it's insects, whether it's
plants,
a weed, whether it's a, you know, anything invasive, or maybe just something you want to identify that we can send to the herbarium. So,
Yeah, we could use some instruction, that's for sure.
Examples.
And I'm sure you see it all.
I've seen a lot of different
things. I've seen it all. I bet I see it all.
Before I came over here, I was processing a sample, and there were socks in it and lots of alcohol, and I would prefer not to have had to deal with that.
Oh.
My goodness.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes.
It's different stuff.
Like to preserve it, like rubbing alcohol, or
there seemed to be some rubbing alcohol in there, and then there was another odor that I couldn't quite place my finger on. It could have been vinegar, but I'm not sure. It could have been the socks.
could have been the socks.
You need to write a book on how samples have come into you.
That's crazy.
That is crazy. But
we've gotten foot water, like people soak their feet in vinegar. I've received pants in the mail. Lots of different things.
Oh, I have no words for that.
I
have no words.
I ain't touching.
Yeah.
Sorry, I derailed you.
Yeah. That's okay. Yeah, but, you know, it just goes to show that people are serious about getting their insects identified, though. And I mean, and they really are, kind of like we said at the very beginning, because it's something that they think is, it's bothering them in some way, shape, or form. And then your imagination goes wild. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that I have seen with folks that have an insect problem. And it's just like the what ifs in their mind just take over. And they're almost just, I don't know the word, but not everybody, but I do see that. We all have seen that, and I certainly know you have.
Yeah, there's a lot of anxiety with it. I mean, you are afraid you're going to get bit, you're going to get stung, they're eating your house, they're eating your food. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's all these different angles with insects, but like was pointed out before, not always going to have actual negative impact. Sometimes they're good.
Right.
But not the ones we're going to talk about today.
That's right. Today we're going to talk about invasive species, the ones that move in uninvited. And we've got a new one here in Kentucky.
We do. A brand new member of the bluegrass, the spotted lanternfly, was first found in Kentucky this past October.
I think we were enjoying some training, our A&R updates that we have to do every year, about the time that broke. When you come to Bowling Green to talk to us about it, David's still trying to process the enjoying part.
Yeah, I'm still rolling that. I'm not sure that's exactly what I was doing.
But about the time that we were in those trainings is when you were coming down to talk to us, and I believe it was it Carroll County where that was first?
Gallatin
County, right next door.
Yep. Yeah, so that was where the first find was, a kind of concerned homeowner they had heard through the Extension grapevine that they could report sort of suspicious looking bugs to their agent or to this email address that we have, reportapest@uky.edu. And the agent came out, took some pictures, they chatted, and then they sent the email in. And it was, you know, like an alarm bell, the red phone starts ringing in the Department of Entomology.
It's right on your desk.
Yeah, pretty much, there's a live one here. Like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
The Office of the State Entomologist, a regulatory agency within our department, they responded and went out and took a look. And it turned out to be a true infestation instead of just being a sighting. Mm. A sighting is when you find like an adult or a nymph. An infestation, you have more than one life stage present. So these were adults, and they were laying eggs on the trees of heaven that were on this person's property. It's interesting because this is right across the river from Switzerland County, Indiana, which was the first find ever in Indiana. And it used to be the furthest west that the pest was. We think it probably naturally kind of flew from Switzerland County over to Kentucky. I wanted to get to Sparta, maybe get to the racetrack, something like that. But it seems like a natural spread situation rather than our more traditional invasive species spread, which is where we accidentally move it in firewood or other packaging and material. This one seemed to have actually flown across the river.
So if Switzerland County, Indiana, was the first place it was located there, is it still the only place, or have they found it other places as well?
In Indiana, it's weird. They've got it in Switzerland County. Then they found it up by Fort Wayne the next year. And I think they have another new find this year. In 2023, spotted lanternfly actually kind of had a big year. It was found in four new states. So besides Kentucky, it was found in Tennessee a couple weeks before our find. A little bit before that, it was found up by Chicago, Illinois. And then somewhere in there, it was also found out by Des Moines, Iowa. So big jumps, probably sort of turning a corner with this pest. And in the next few years, you'll see a lot of the map filling in. We fought the good fight and kind of kept it contained for a good period of time in the mid-Atlantic, but I don't think that's going to hold any further.
Those are fairly random distribution points.
Yes.
if you're looking on a map. Yeah. Are those all considered to be natural distribution?
Or? No, those would all be accidental transportation, human-assisted movement. So the Switzerland County one, the original discovery there, it turned out to be sort of near a man's house who had moved there from Pennsylvania, which was the first state ever to be infested. And he was traveling some during the quarantine period and going back home to Pennsylvania and coming back. So it's likely that there was some accidental transportation there. I don't know how it got up towards Huntington or Fort Wayne. But then with these Chicago, the Tennessee one, which is by Nashville, and then the Des Moines one, that's all got to be people transported it on a tractor trailer. It was brought in on infested nursery stock, something to that effect.
Right. I think there's a ton of people that really don't understand a lot of the distribution that happens with bugs or insects of all kinds. I mean, kind of go through with us the different things that they can be transported on and how that happens sometimes.
Sure. So when we're talking about invasive species, unfortunately, they're brought in a lot on packing material. So that kind of wooden shipping pallet that you see at a train station or at the docks or wherever you're at, those can contain insects kind of hidden in the wood. They're living in it as larvae, or they can hide in between the slats. They get taped in over in China or in Japan or one of these other nations we do business with, and then it's shipped here and then they're released. Once it's here, we see a lot of movement with firewood. This can be eggs or larvae inside of the wood, or they can be hiding in between it. Hay and straw and all that kind of stuff. And then nursery stock is a good way to get moved around. With this one, spotted lanternfly, unfortunately, it also loves to just sort of hang out on vehicles. So it'll get up in the wheel wells of trucks and cars. They'll also lay their eggs on automobiles. Typically not going to result in like them hatching in a new spot and popping out there. But it's still quite alarming, I think, to know that they see the vehicle as something they can use like that. And then the other weird one is trains. With this pest, we've seen it get moved in Pennsylvania via trains, and we're afraid that might happen here. It's just like, you know, in the Depression era, people would hop on a train. These bugs, they can get on it when people are packing it up, and then they just get moved into a new county and hop off. We do this, unfortunately, in a lot of ways. Sometimes even on purpose. You meet people who they buy these things, and they release them on purpose. They think they're doing something good. unfortunately just causing havoc.
What kind of climate can they live in, any climates? I mean, obviously they came from Pennsylvania, so I'm assuming they can live down here pretty good.
So just generally invasive species?
Yeah.
I mean, when you look globally, you'd have to look at nations that have similar climates to ours. So you're looking at Asia mostly at this point. We've brought a lot of the European ones already. We did that a couple hundred years ago with colonization. But now that we're doing so much more trade with Asiatic nations, if they have something that can live there and it kind of matches up with Kentucky or with Indiana or wherever, then if it gets here, it'll be able to survive. And once it gets kind of a toehold, they're just going to outcompete everything that is sort of their analog here. Mm-hmm. So spotted lanternfly, it's a sap-feeding insect. We have lots of stink bugs and aphids and things that feed similarly to it. But our trees have adapted to those over a long time. But this one, they don't have any defenses against. So they can outcompete and sort of outmaneuver all of those native organisms and take over that territory.
Mm-hmm. So you said that on the cars, I have seen some pictures where they're on cars, I believe. Is that something that is normal when you start seeing on these places that have, there's been identified and it's been a problem? Is that a common way that they're being transported? Is just through a passenger vehicle, not a train,
right,
not a semi, but just anybody's vehicle?
From what I understand in Pennsylvania, yeah. If you had an infested county and then an uninfested county, if people traveled between them for work or for leisure, then yes, there were incidences of them accidentally moving them with their vehicle, just a regular passenger vehicle from one county to the next. They had a pretty strict quarantine in Pennsylvania. They still do, I should say. People would have to get like placards that said they were from a county with lanternfly, and they could be inspected to make sure that they weren't traveling with some unexpected guests hidden up in the wheel well.
Where's that inspection done at? I mean, is it typically a roadside inspection?
I would say that this would be when you got to the parking lot, like if they were driving. I never have experienced it. I have friends in Pennsylvania, and I don't think they ever had it happen to them. But ostensibly, you could be checked at your destination. Like if it was in an uninfested county, somebody could come through and check, an ag person maybe.
Well, and that's why I was asking.
Department of Ag.
When I think of like outside of this country, or even trying to get into the United States, we see these advisories at airports. No traveling with food, mm-hmm. No traveling with fruit. That's always a big one, or anything like that. And that's not because of tax reasons or because we don't want that food in our country. It's because of the opportunity for a hitchhiker,
yep,
to ride into the country. I know in, like South America, for instance, where we have a lot of different nations on one continent to travel back and forth from country to country, they have pretty detailed inspection points, right, where they inspect trucks and they're looking for these invasive species. And I just wondered if it wasn't something similar.
Unfortunately, there's never enough money to do something quite like that with a situation like this. People were asking if there'd be a quarantine here in Kentucky for if things can go in and out of Gallatin. We just, the regulatory power isn't there to install a quarantine.
Sure.
So we're not going to have that here, which can be good and bad. It might mean that trade gets to continue at pace, but it also might mean that we have a faster spread here than they did in other states.
Sure. Yeah. With this particular insect, let's talk a little bit about the culture that it lives in, maybe what it feeds upon, because those might be some ways in the future we can limit the expanse of this particular outbreak.
Absolutely. So it's a sap-feeding pest, as I mentioned before. They feed on up to about 100 different species of plants. Their favorite host is called the Tree of Heaven, which is itself another invasive species brought here purposefully as an ornamental, I believe. Mm-hmm. They can be quite pretty. But unfortunately, they can find each other here, and the lanternfly can feed on it, and then will reproduce successfully. They don't need the Tree of Heaven, but it is their preferred food source. Outside of that, they like maples. They like to get on roses and a few other ornamentals. Agriculturally speaking, since this is an ag podcast, we're not going to see impacts on corn or soybeans or any of our other sort of prime crops. We'd be talking about very specialty type situations. So people who are maple syrup producers, vineyards, they're the ones that are kind of the most under threat. In other states, we've seen vineyard industries suffer from this pest. There are control strategies, some sprays that we could talk about But that's the plant that's kind of the most susceptible agriculturally. But it doesn't kill most of the trees. It just sort of stresses them out. So your maple tree is not going to die. It really is just sort of like a big annoyance. It's a hard invasive species to kind of pep people up about, because like when we talked about emerald ash borer a few years ago, you know, that's an entire genus of trees under threat. They might all die if we don't do something about this. Japanese beetle mows through a soybean field as quick as it can, right? I mean, we have these really direct impacts. With this one, we're just sort of saying it's going to get in your yard. There'll be thousands to millions of them. They poop all over everything. They don't get in your house. They don't bite or sting. But not too many people want to have a couple hundred thousand insects crawling off of a tree in their backyard, right? So it's hard to put into a package, I think, a public relations package.
You know, you speak of the tree of heaven, though, being an invasive species in itself. If we were to make some moves to remove these from our landscape, it wouldn't necessarily be hurting the landscape per se, like it would if they were an oak or some other type of species that had a high monetary value assigned to it.
Absolutely. And if you remove some of the trees of heaven, you will hopefully cut down on the attraction to your property for this pest. You won't completely eliminate it. They might still show up and feed on your maple or what have you, but it does help, and it helps to curtail some of their populations. The tree of heaven is also notoriously hard to get rid of. Sometimes the act of chopping it down causes many more of them to spring up. So we do have to be very purposeful with our approaches, do some trim and paint with glyphosate or what have you to try and kill them. They do reproduce in an interesting way. They also get into areas that nobody takes care of.
Right.
So a rail yard, roadsides, these places that don't get a lot of intensive management, they just move into these kind of habitats.
In the town where I live, where we had a lot of tree of heaven at one time, was around a specific set of bridges to where a road split and became two one-lane roads.
Okay.
And it crossed a river, so you had two bridges within, say, 100 yards of each other. And because that was a riverbank that was interior to town and no walking trails or anything like that, there were a lot of them.
Yep.
Now, they eventually grew out and were kind of crowding over the bridge, so the city went in and cleaned all that up.
Okay.
But we had a lot of those at one time there in one place.
You could have been the first county with spotted lanternfly.
that was before it was ever, even in Indiana, unfortunately.
Before it was an invasive inkling in our eye.
Yeah. And you know, when if the folks are out there and they want to do the Google search or do any type of search on the spotted lanternfly, it's actually a quite attractive bug.
Yes, so, it's very pretty. I remember my first time seeing it, that we have an Entomology Society of America here in the U.S., and we have a national bug meeting every year, a few thousand entomologists.
That's a fun time.
Lots of pushing up our glasses and arguing about bug names and stuff.
Getting my tickets next year.
We're going to be in Phoenix next year, so, you know.
There you go.
I remember at a meeting I went to a few years ago, it was just after they'd found it in Pennsylvania, and somebody killed a bunch of them, and they pinned them to their poster. So you could come up and take one, take it home to show people and start to warn them about it. And I remember thinking that, I was like, this is an amazingly beautiful insect. It's kind of this weird khaki color on its wings, but when they fold them up, they have red underwings. So it has this odd sort of pinkish khaki hue. They've got this like alligator skin pattern on part of their wings and spots on the other part. They make spots and stripes, a bit of a fashion faux pas, but they make it work.
Yeah, I remember when I saw a picture of one, I thought, well, no, that's a different. I mean, it's easy. Yeah. I think in a way it would be easy to identify.
Right.
Because some insects are not that easy to identify. No, they're very difficult,
they're
actually.
Just brown or drab, yeah.
Yes.
This one is very different. But there are some things that people see in America that get confused for. The biggest one that we receive is the leopard moth. Mm-hmm. So we have this white and black moth. It has sort of similar spots to what we see on the lanternfly. It's about the same size. We've also got a lot of harlequin bugs that have been sent in that have been thought to be this. Box elder bugs, different kinds of milkweed bugs. They all have similar coloration, but none of them have the right combination of colors, spots, and stripes that matches up with the lanternfly.
Do they all look just alike? I mean, do they all pretty well look just alike? I mean, there are not any variations.
Not a lot of variation with this one, yeah. They're all very similar. The differences go with the development. So they start life as an egg. The egg is kind of this, it looks almost like a coin purse, and it will be laid and then put under this kind of muddy smear. So it looks like somebody's taken a putty knife and kind of mm-hmm. smeared caulking or mm-hmm. or whatever on a tree.
Yeah.
Once that hatches, they come out as a nymph. So nymphs are immatures of true bugs. They generally look like the adult form, except they don't have their wings. In this case, they look a little different because they're black with white dots until they get to their penultimate stage, the second to last stage. They get this kind of red war paint on them, and you can see their wing buds more obviously. And then when they mature into the adult, they have this kind of cicada shape, teardrop shape from the side, long wings, and then the distinct coloration we've been talking about.
What is their life expectancy? I mean, well, how long do they live? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know.
So eggs have been laid here over the last couple months. So from October into December, they're laying eggs and dying as adults. Those eggs will hatch the next spring, and they'll live throughout that whole summer. An individual that started life in May of 1 year, they could live until about December of that year before they'll perish. They don't get into houses and overwinter. They do try sometimes, mm-hmm. But they can't survive. So they get about a growing season.
So they're basically, after they lay their eggs, then not long after that, they're going to...
Like a lot of insects, yeah. The males, once they mate, they die. They've done mm-hmm. their thing. The females, once they lay their eggs, mm-hmm. they've expended all of their energy, and they perish.
Yeah. So the biggest... It's more of a nuisance thing, really, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, it's going to affect people's lives. I mean, you can look up news stories from Philadelphia, from Trenton, New Jersey, from New York City, and you'll just see these people, they feel like they're under siege.
Yeah, they're walking around, and, yeah, I've watched it.
They'll get on businesses, the door will be covered with bugs. They do get on trees in high numbers. And people in Pennsylvania report they don't want to go to the park anymore. They don't want to have backyard barbecues anymore because... They do defecate a lot. They're sucking that sap out. It's not very nutritious, so they got to drink a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And they're constantly going to the bathroom as a result. I always joke that it's this sticky butt juice that's all over everything. And it smells very fermentive, I guess. Am I allowed to see?
Yeah.
Am I going to get censored?
Yeah.
No, I was painting a picture in my mind.
I try to be as evocative as possible. It does smell kind of weird. I've been to the site in Switzerland County, and I mean, it's just everywhere. It'll attract mm-hmm. sooty mold. It looks like this black plague is kind of working its way through the area. It attracts a lot of stinging insects. They drink it up. It's like a big gulp for them. And so you'll get bees and wasps and flies that come into the area. And then honeybees sometimes will even switch from going to flowers and getting nectar. They'll only start feeding on this honeydew. And so their honey is then made out of honeydew, and it changes the flavor. People notice, and then you have to advertise it as such. It's a very multi-tiered kind of organism when we're talking about this invasive.
And once it is there, there's not a lot you can do?
It's interesting that you bring that up, because we were just talking to some Pennsylvanians on my podcast, and they were talking about it seems like there's a wave. So there's like a decade-long wave where it kind of has big problems, and then it moves out. And then it just seems like it hops around season to season mm-hmm. where it pops up. And so you don't see these huge numbers like they have in the recent past. They see this more of reduction but localized problems. So it could be that it'll just sort of be in the background, mm-hmm. which we do see with some invasive species. Things kind mm-hmm. of equilibrate. Things get used to it. And nature kind of finds a way mm-hmm. to coexist. It's never the same that it was before. But it's better than the alternative, which is death and destruction. So,
right, right.
Yeah.
So it just makes a big mess, more or less.
Pretty much. Just poops all over everything. It's the worst kind of fraternity brother.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that would really put a damper on your
cookouts,
I mean,
your
and stuff in the summertime when you're having...
Yeah.
Park activities, like
you
said.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
people have slipped because of it. They fall and break bones. Yeah, yeah.
So you talked about, is there a possibility of some kind of preventative spray? Is there any kind of chemicals that we could use to prevent some of this?
Sure. If you have it on a plant and you want to spray it directly, any of the pyrethroids that we use for pest control will work. So that's things like bifenthrin, cyhalothrin, very common over-the-counter products that you'd find at Lowe's and Home Depot, other mm-hmm. hardware stores. Those will take care of the adults and the nymphs that you see. But that does contaminate the environment and mean that you could accidentally impact other things. So some people like to use a systemic application of dinotefuran. There are a couple of other products that you can inject into trees, inject into plants, and it'll take it up. And as the lanternfly feeds on it, it's just kind of like what we've done with emerald ash borer control, except slightly different in terms of how they acquire it. So they suck that sap out, it's hidden in the sap, and then it kills them. We have seen in Pennsylvania, they'll go through and they chop down a bunch of the tree of heaven, and they'll leave like a few big ones behind, and they inject those, and then all the lanternflies come to them and feed, and you kill them in droves. We do have that product labeled here in Kentucky. We have an emergency label for it. So arborists that are in the state, as this pest begins to spread, they'll be able to offer their services to inject people's trees in particular.
So is there hot spots in the state that either through past experiences that, okay, we need to really keep an eye on this area because of this or this, you know, that we really need to be looking at that area because it's very likely that this might be where it comes in. Is that what we're doing in the state, or is there anything like that going on?
We have some monitoring going on for it, especially along the Ohio River Valley. We have people setting out traps and looking for it. We've also tried to instigate some citizen science projects where people can go out and look for Tree of Heaven and report it to us so that we can build a map that shows us, all right, this is where we have big clusters of it. That could be a hot spot. If I had to predict where it would be the worst, it'll probably be the bluegrass region and eastern Kentucky, particularly any forests that have Tree of Heaven problems, anywhere that people aren't going very often and where plant life is a little bit thicker, I would say. Western Kentucky, you don't have as much of a contiguous forest type situation out there. Things are a little patchier in the landscape. So it could be less of a problem there, but it could also get really bad in pockets of woods or on different – do you have a lot of vineyards out there?
We do have a few.
Yeah, I thought so.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So those would be places to look. The other weird thing that happened with it last year was there was two dead ones found in Letcher County and a shipment that came from Pennsylvania. And the agent there called me and he sent me the bugs. And it was a very strange situation where they checked this packing material after finding it. They were afraid there would be eggs in there or something. But it was frightening because he was describing to me the farm that it was found on is in between a vineyard and like a Tree of Heaven infestation. So it was like the perfect storm. If it had been alive, it would have gotten started down there very quickly. It sounded
like.
What are the, you brought up something there in the packing material and you talked about it before. So if we are getting some shipments from somewhere that may have had an infestation, what is the best way to dispose of that? What's the best way to, you know, to, if there was some eggs had been laid on that material or in a pallet or something, what's the best way for us to dispose of that?
You can crush the eggs pretty easily if you just take a putty knife or a pocket knife or even your thumb. It's easy to squish them. You would do well to take a picture of that and send it in and kind of report it. I mentioned report a pest at UKY before. That's one way that you can do that. You can also let the company know because that means they need to go out into their shipping yard and probably take a closer look. This is something we've actually talked about as kind of an extension project for Kentucky, is getting people to do self-inspections at their business to make sure they're not shipping the pest around once it gets a little thicker. We see this in Pennsylvania. They actually have like little certificates that they'll hang up and say, we're spotted lanternfly checkers, or I can't remember exactly what they call it. But they check their cars before they go out. They check their trucks. They check their goods. I think that would be something in the future. But I would say you just have to look in all the corners. They're going to get down into the wood slats, into the boxes. That's where they're going to lay their eggs. If you buy something and it comes from Pennsylvania, I would definitely check that. Yeah. Most of that state is infested at this point.
Yeah. So just every little crack, crook, cranny, whatever, you need to be checking it out because you never know.
It stands out, and it's weird. People notice these kinds of things, right? Yeah. I mean, we don't always look at our packing material as we're tearing stuff apart, but when you see something odd, you do usually pause.
And, true.
Right. Yeah.
True. Yeah. What percentage of the eggs that are laid actually hatch and survive?
So in an egg mass, there can be around 40 eggs on average. And I would say that 90 to 100% of those are probably going to hatch.
Of course.
That mud smear that I mentioned, it's part of one of their invasive attributes. When the mom puts that over the top of the eggs, it protects them for the winter. Mm. And we see their survivorship under that mud go up quite a bit. So they survive even the Pennsylvanian winters. So balmy Kentucky, they're going to do pretty well in.
They're going to flourish.
Those insects are pretty smart. Yeah, they really are. I mean,
it feels that way, especially with invasives, because the ones that are going to be the most successful are the ones that have just this weird trick that for some reason they developed where they're from, and then they slide through our defenses. They get through a quarantine or whatever, and it's like, oh, actually, this is very helpful here. And they do take advantage of that.
You've mentioned two climates that we know, Pennsylvania and Kentucky. Uh-huh. You've mentioned some other places where they've popped up where we think we've moved them. Are there any climates within the United States that where it would not fare well?
Maybe
the desert southwest?
Yeah, they do think that sort of southwestern United States, Texas, and Florida, as I would probably say most of the southeast, actually, it might struggle in those areas. It might be too warm for it, and they're not adapted for that. They are used to seasonality, to having a winter. And so if you get much further than Tennessee, things get a little warmer. Mm-hmm. They might not do as well down there.
Hmm. Well, I tell you what, big stuff for folks to stay keyed in on. You know, we've spent a lot of time talking about spotted lanternfly, some other invasive species that we've dealt with for quite a while, one being the European ash borer. Uh-huh. County, where are we at with that across the state? What's our county distribution and so forth?
So no new finds of emerald ash borer were made in 2023. We've held still on that one from 2022 to now. Not all 120 counties are infested. It is missing from several western counties, but it's kind of filling the map in. So there's a Department of Forestry map that goes around. I haven't seen a new one this year because there's no new counties to add. So I don't quite remember all the ones that are missing, but you mentioned that you don't have it yet. So that's one county where it's missing.
I'm in Christian County. They're not there. They have been found in Hopkins County, just to the north of me.
Right.
I work in Hopkins County, so I kindly pay attention to that going back and forth.
Right. And we appreciate that because the people that find these things are usually the folks that live there. I mean, everybody always asks me and the other entomologists, be like, oh, you know, where do you think it's going to go? How's it going to happen? It's like, well, people that live and work in these areas, especially the ones that are outdoors, they're the ones that are going to know best. They're the ones that find these things first usually. So I appreciate that you take a look around.
Well, and where I'm looking specifically, like in Hopkins County, we have a very large park there, Mar Park. Mm-hmm. Vicki's familiar with it. And that's where we're building a new extension office.
Oh, okay.
It has a lot of ash trees, and they're perfectly healthy.
Yes, good.
So that's something that I pay attention to there because it has been located in the county.
Right.
I've got ash trees on my property just to the south in Christian County, but I've seen no activity whatsoever. So because they're my trees, I pay attention to them.
Well, and it's I like that you asked that question about it because people in the eastern part of the state have also kind of forgotten about it. Mm-hmm. We get lots of calls every year about, oh, do I have to treat for that still? They want to stop paying for the treatments. It's like, if you want to keep your tree, I would keep it going.
That or cut the tree down.
That or cut the tree down, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, and with the movement of that particular, you could talk about like Ohio, for instance, how the landscape has changed with ash trees or now without ash trees in a lot of places.
Yeah, Ohio, Indiana, and Michigan, those were some of the early states to get hit by that one. And it was almost like a very specific nuclear bomb. I mean, you would go into these neighborhoods, beautiful ash cathedrals kind of lining the street. They were the replacements for the elms that they lost a couple of decades before from a different invasive problem. We picked ash because it's such a tough tree, but this one insect, I mean, it's adapted to feed on ash. Our ash have no defenses against it, basically. And so you would see these neighborhoods have beautiful shade, probably keeping cooler in the summer, warmer in the winter, not a lot of stormwater runoff, and just all gone because over the course of about 7 years, it just moves in, takes over, and kills those trees. States like Kentucky were a little more prepared. We didn't see quite that devastation. Cities and towns were able to save some money up, do some treatments, do some slow removal of ash and replace it with different species. We've seen those strategies get even more fine-tuned in other states. So it's one that there's a handle on it, but it's not gone, and we still need to be managing for.
Hmm. Well, Jonathan, I know we are kind of coming towards the end of the show, but I do want to give you the opportunity to advertise your podcast.
Absolutely.
And if you'll tell folks about it and kind of what y'all talk about and maybe where to find it.
We are Arthropod. It's arthro-pod. We're on the web, arthur-pod.blogspot.com. We're on all the different podcatchers. You always have to put the dash in or it won't show up, though. It's an entomology-themed show. It's me and an entomologist from Nebraska and another one from Penn State. Their names are Jody and Mike. And we talk about all kinds of buggy things. So we'll pick up invasive species and talk about them for a couple episodes. We do entomology history, which I know sounds like a dry topic, but we try to make it interesting. We had a series that was about the history of Napoleon Bonaparte and insects, how they stalled him out in several wars. We did how the spongy moth was introduced to the U.S. I did one just a while back about Colorado potato beetle and its history. And how it was like a Cold War hot topic that the communists accused us of releasing in Europe. Yeah. We do some cultural entomology stuff. We watched Starship Troopers last year and talked about that. We watched The Fly this year and talked about that. Yeah. So anything that you can think of with bugs, we try to talk it up, and we have a lot of fun with it.
I mean, sounds like
you can see us at the next convention, the next bug convention.
There you go.
It may be recording live.
Y'all have to go with me if we do that.
Absolutely.
You know, one of the things we always do towards the end of the show is we like to wrap things up with a timely tip, and it's just something that would maybe be pertinent time-wise to producers during the time of the year, or maybe pertinent to the subject that we talked about. We didn't talk about it beforehand, but while I was sitting here making a few notes, I thought a good timely tip, as we're talking about invasive species, is to remind folks, whether you're producers of ag commodities or whether you're consumers, anybody else living around the countryside, is to just be vigilant and be on the watch for any of these invasive species. When you hear about something on the news, even if it is a lady Asian beetle, when you hear somebody talking about that, take the time to pull out your smartphone. Most people carry them nowadays. Mm-hmm. Look that up. See what it looks like, and then you can be on the watch for it in your own house, in your own landscape. You never know that somebody, you know, in the south central part of the state might be the next spot for a spotted lanternfly.
Absolutely. Yeah. So. We saw that work with the case here in Gallatin County that we talked about. It was just a concerned homeowner that had heard about it through the news and through Extension, and without them, we wouldn't have known, and it would be kind of festering over there. So please do take a look around.
In his case, he actually found something of note. Unlike all those folks who come into our offices a while back with proposed murder hornets.
Yes.
I still get those.
Well, we appreciate you being here with us today. We want to thank you for this week's information, and thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.